Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, you know, America's always been a melting pot from the very beginning. And today, with the tremendous mobility and universal access to education, that process has accelerated. Used to be that there were populations that were much more regionally fixed and just stuck where they were and stratified socially in very rigid ways, right? And there were groups that were marginalized in those days that didn't fit the standard categories, who were really forced to the fringes of society, both socially and geographically. They had to live where nobody else wanted to live, that kind of thing. One of those groups, and they were all around the country, but in Appalachia, in the very eastern tip of Tennessee, in the area around Cumberland Gap, in southwestern Virginia and far eastern Kentucky, was a group called the Melungeons. And being from Florida, I had never heard of the Melungeons, but it turns out that they are well known in this area that I described. We'll try to tell their story in half an hour. My guest is Wayne Winkler, who's the director of WETS at East Tennessee State University in Johnson City, Tennessee. Welcome, Wayne.
Thank you for having me.
Wayne turns out to be a Melungeon. He found that out as a boy, and he's become an expert on it and has written a book called Walking Toward the Sunset, The Melungeons of Appalachia. So Wayne's going to tell us all about the Melungeons. Why don't you just give us their background?
Well, if I were writing a dictionary definition, I would probably say that the Melungeons are one of several mixed ethnic groups that were located primarily in the southeastern United States. The Melungeons were first documented at the beginning of the 19th century in the Clinch River region of southwestern Virginia and northeast Tennessee. So that's the short answer. But, of course, there's a lot more to it than that. The Melungeons were considered to be a mixture of African, Native American, and European ancestry. But over the years, many theories of their origin, many myths and legends came up about the Melungeons, so they've always been considered somewhat mysterious. And there's been a lot of interest, primarily from newspaper and magazine writers, but in the last 50 or 60 years, scientists have been looking at the Melungeons and the whole phenomenon of mixed ethnic populations.
So they were triracial, but I think there's a lot of controversy about even that part and the mix of races. And, you know, in reading about it and in reading your book and as I often do, reading Wikipedia to become an instant expert on a subject, which can be pretty useful, really. The different theories are very divergent in some ways. I mean, it ranges from Anatolian people from Turkey to Portuguese and Spanish mix, and there's a whole kind of set of theories that to some extent overlap and to some extent diverge and compete with each other as to where they came from. And it is interesting that a group of people have such divergent, even among themselves, ideas about where they were from. What are the predominant views about the mix of people? You said they were triracial, but be more specific, like then, to break it down. Where did they think they came from, most of them?
Well, if you talk to the Melungeons of a generation or two ago, before there was a lot of publicity, before they were exposed to a lot of these theories, if you ask the Melungeons, they would probably say that their ancestors were Portuguese and Indian.
Okay.
And that was really the way they looked at themselves. But the idea of Portuguese really originated with a newspaper article in the 1840s in which a Melungeon supposedly told the reporter that their people were Portuguese. Hmm. Now, that may have applied only to his family. It may have applied to the Melungeons as a whole. It's interesting to note that this individual who told the reporter that had recently been put on trial for illegal voting because of his suspected African ancestry. Hmm. And throughout the 19th century and part of the 20th century, along the eastern seaboard, Portuguese was considered by many to be a euphemism for suspected African ancestry.
Oh, is that right?
So
huh.
the whole idea of Portuguese, it may be that is a family tradition that's been handed down from generations. It could be that people read about that in the same magazine article that everyone else read about it and said, oh, that's who we are. So that's one of the things I think a lot of the history that Melungeons have of themselves has been passed down through the media as well.
Hmm. But I think that I did read that, you know, so many of these stories are all very plausible. And so one plausible version is that there were slave trading transshipment points in Portugal way back then in the 17th century, even in 18th century, certainly. And so there were Portuguese workers and sailors in those ports who may have married some slaves or kept them as, you know, mistresses or just flat out raped them on occasion. And there were children of those unions that were then half-breeds, as it would have been called then or whatever, who were half Portuguese, half African. And those people may have been used as servants, let's say, I mean, and then come to the colonies. So certainly that's a plausible source of people who would have had part Portuguese and or Spanish ancestry and part African. Do you ascribe to that at all?
Well, there are several plausible theories. That's one of the interesting things about studying the Melungeons, and I think it's hard to resist looking at history, looking at the facts, and then trying to see if there is a way that this could have happened or that could have happened. And,
yeah.
And there are so many things that are expressed in some of the theories of origin for the Melungeons that are plausible. And it's very difficult to go back and get documentation about these people because they kind of existed, so to speak, off the radar.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't a lot of written documents. Birth certificates were unknown in the early 19th century. You have to go by land records. So people who didn't own property, there might be no record of them, no tax records, no property deeds or anything like that. So you look at the things that you can find, and you do see a migration pattern. One of the stories about the Melungeons was that when the first white settlers came into the Clinch River region, they found these people there.
Yeah.
And that's been one of the stories that has been accepted as fact about the Melungeons.
Hmm.
But research has shown, research primarily by Jack Goines of Rogersville, Tennessee, he shows at least one core group of the Melungeons moving from the Louisa County, Virginia area, kind of along the border between Virginia and North Carolina, moving to the New River area, moving into Wilkes County, then into Ashe County, then up into Virginia and down into Tennessee. So their arrival in the region pretty much coincided with that of the white settlers that moved in about 1800.
Hmm. Early on. Well, that's the derivation of your title, Walking Toward the Sunset, and I guess there was also, that was the name of a documentary play, in a way, that started the coming out of the idea of Melungeons. We'll talk about that a little later. But they were walking west, right? So they were, like Americans do, they were going to a place where they could be free of social restriction and oppression and could have some land and could live freely, even though it was tough living back then. So they were actually there before the Scotch-Irish settlers in some of these areas then.
Well, they moved pretty much along with them.
Okay.
The westward movement took a lot of pioneers, and these were primarily people who didn't own land or didn't own good land where they were. They were looking for better land, better opportunities. The Melungeons were exactly the same. They were looking for exactly the same things. One attraction of Tennessee was when Tennessee became a state in 1796, the original Constitution guaranteed the vote to all free men. There was no mention of color. And, of course, women were not permitted to vote, but all free men were permitted to vote. That meant that free persons of color were allowed to vote. That was changed in the 1834 Constitutional Convention. They restricted the vote to free white men. But originally, people of color were permitted to vote if they were not slaves.
And so there was always the supposition from their appearance that they were not white or that they were what we call colored people back then. Going back to their origins, I read a description of something called the Anatolian bump, Anatolian being a reference to Turkey. And in your book, you describe an area, I forget the name of the town, it started with a C, but there's a mountain.
Çeşme.
Yeah, okay. Where the people there referred to themselves, I guess, as Melankan, and that there was a legend or a history locally of people who had been taken away by, was it Spanish invaders, or at
Portuguese,
least
Portuguese or Spanish,
forcibly removed from there and taken to the colonies. So, you know, so the Anatolian bump is kind of a brow ridge, right, across?
No, it's on the back of the head.
Oh, it's the back of the head.
It's a bump on the back of the head.
Oh, I saw a picture in Wikipedia with a family of people with bump on the front of their head.
Ah, okay.
And in fact, a girl was wearing like a headband. It looked like she was modest and embarrassed. She was, you know, kind of a good-looking girl, and it had covered her bump, I thought, with this headband or something.
That's a theory. I mean, it goes along with the idea that perhaps there was a Middle Eastern or Anatolian origin to the Melungeons. And again, like many theories, that one was really interesting to pursue, but some of the key points in that theory haven't really panned out. That one kind of depended on the idea that Sir Francis Drake left a shipload of Turkish sailors on Roanoke Island. This was prior to the Lost Colony, and these people supposedly dispersed. No evidence has been found to verify that. In fact, the evidence tends to lean away from that. So, so that's, you know, another theory that has been explored and hasn't really been backed up. Of course, new information can always change the way we look at things. My own theory is that the Melungeons really originated with free African-American families in Virginia and North Carolina. Many of the first slaves in this country were not enslaved for life, but were indentured for a period of 7 years. So at the end of that, they were free, but they were not accepted. They were not full citizens. So they were moving west to find new opportunities, just like all Americans were. But they wound up joining with some of the Indian tribes that were in a period of dissolution. They were falling apart, primarily had been depopulated by disease and by conflict with other Native American tribes. They were looking for new blood. These free African Americans were welcomed into the tribe. As they moved west, they started intermarrying with their European neighbors. And I think that's what most observers have thought over the years. That's what most scientific research has indicated. Recent DNA tests have shown that through the male line, when they can measure an unbroken male line of descent from some of the core Melungeon families that were identified in the early 19th century, they find a haplogroup that traces back to Africa. So the Native American doesn't show up in that, which would indicate that the Native American genes came in through the maternal side, through the females, and it wouldn't show up in a Y chromosome DNA test. So that's my theory, is that it is basically a triracial mixture. But within that, these free slaves might have a Portuguese background. The first slaves in America were from Angola. They were literate. They were Christian. They had been baptized by the people who controlled that country, which was Portugal. The Portuguese controlled that part of Africa. So the Portuguese aspect may have some validity. There may be other aspects that have validity, but still within that context that I described. So at least that's my theory. Anyone who researches Melungeons is entitled to have their own theory.
Well, that's your story, and I'm sticking to it. It sounds good to me. But, you know, there's also the phenomenon of slave owners, you know, having sexual relations with the female slaves, and that's another source of all of that, too. Somebody I read in your book, and this is kind of a harsh phrase, it was some old cracker, described Melungeons at the time that he was quoted in this description as being a mixture of poor white trash, renegade Indians, and runaway slaves. And although that's a harsh phrase in our terms today, that may have been somewhat like you're describing.
Well, that kind of goes along with a point that I made in my book, that whatever the origin of the Melungeons, whether or not they actually had African ancestry, they were treated as if they did, socially and in many cases legally. They had the same status as African Americans. So whether or not that was warranted, that's the way it was.
And attitudes like the one that I just described, that a guy expressed, which would have been common at the time, helped to confirm their hardline view and treatment of those people as being less than them, right? So it kind of helped keep everybody in their place, so to speak, and kept the Melungeons on the margins of society. You're listening to American Variety Radio, and I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're here with Wayne Winkler, who is the author of Walking Toward the Sunset, The Melungeons of Appalachia, a very interesting kind of historical and ethnographic description, very readable too, of the Melungeons and every aspect of what we're talking about here, this people who lived kind of on the margins of an area around eastern Tennessee and southwestern Virginia, starting way back when, even in the late 1600s even possibly, but certainly by 1800 or so. Wayne, there's another kind of the whole aspect to it is the word Melungeon itself has as many different theories, if not more, about its origins as the theories about the origins of the people. And again, we'll talk about them, but the origins that are described for the words are so diverse. They come from different language groups entirely, and yet each one is entirely plausible on its own. Why don't you describe some of those?
Right. Well, we don't know for sure where the word Melungeon came from. The first written record we have of that is in church minutes from Stony Creek Baptist Church in Scott County, Virginia, in southwestern Virginia. So we don't know where the word came from. There were various spellings of it. But one of the most common theories is that it comes from the French word mélange, which means mixture. There are also...
And the plural of that word would be mélangeon, which would be people who are a mixture.
Right.
Mélangeon is darn close to Melungeon, right? It's
right.
Spelled the same, essentially.
There is also an old English word that you can find in the works of Sir Edmund Spenser in The Faery Queen, which was a very popular book in that time, and it uses the word malingin, which means deceitful and full of guile. And it's obviously a very negative connotation, which would match the way many people viewed the Melungeons at that time. Other theories have included milongo, which is supposedly a Afro-Portuguese term meaning shipmate. Brent Kennedy, in his book, The Melungeons, The Resurrection of a Proud People, he was a proponent of the idea of Turkish origin, and he traced the word back to the Arabic melungin, which means cursed soul or one who has been abandoned by God. These are all very negative. We don't have a meaning that says, like, the nice people or the good-looking people. They seem to be kind of negative. One theory even has it from the Italian word for eggplant. An eggplant is a dark-skinned vegetable, so... The idea of referring to these people with that word would have some sort of a logic to it.
What was that word?
Melungeon. Melungeon,
okay.
Yes.
So again, all these words are so similar and yet coming from different languages. I mean, Turkish, for gosh sakes, you know. So they all sound plausible, you know, and yet, as you say, the words are largely very negative in connotation. So it's not names that the people would have given themselves. They clearly were given by...
The
white settlers around them, right?
Brent Kennedy argued that the name was one that they used for themselves. Judging from the way people reacted, even when I was a child, I didn't hear the word. I know of older people who were told, don't say that word. That word is an insult. It's a fighting word.
Huh.
And the Melungeons certainly did not describe themselves with that word prior to the late 1960s.
Hmm. I mentioned at the outset that you yourself are of Melungeon descent, maybe not entirely, I think more on your mother's side.
My dad's side.
Your dad's side, okay. Then how did you first determine or learn that you were of Melungeon descent and what they were, since it wasn't really talked about at all?
My dad's family was, they were all dark-skinned people, and my dad described his family as being Indian. And later on, I asked him, you know, why did you always describe yourself as Indian? Why not Melungeon? He said, because people know what an Indian is. I don't have all day to explain Melungeons.
Yeah.
But it was something that people didn't talk about prior to, in the late 1960s, Hancock County began an economic development effort. Hancock County has always been one of the poorest counties in America. And they decided that tourism was probably their best bet for bringing dollars into the county. One of the very popular tourist attractions of that time was the outdoor drama. There were many outdoor dramas, and still are, all over the country. And they thought that the Melungeon story would be a good draw for bringing tourist dollars into the area. So they contracted with Kermit Hunter, who wrote many very popular outdoor dramas. And he wrote a drama for them called Walk Toward the Sunset. And it ran from 1969 to 1976. It didn't bring the economic development that they had hoped for. Hancock County really didn't have the infrastructure to take advantage of it. But what did happen was a very fundamental change in people's attitude about Melungeons, not only the Melungeons themselves, but the people who lived around them. This was a county in which the word Melungeon wasn't said. When the Saturday Evening Post did an article about the Melungeons in 1947, everyone in the county, Melungeon and non-Melungeon, was upset by it. They just didn't really want to acknowledge this population as being there. By the end of the outdoor drama in 1976, as you drove into Hancock County, the sign said, "Welcome to Hancock County, home of the Melungeons."
Is that right?
It was something that made Hancock County stand out, and they were taking pride in it. I hasten to add, not everyone took pride in it. Old attitudes die hard.
But at least the Chamber of Commerce did, and that was all it took to get the sign up.
It really did make a big difference in the way people reacted to the Melungeons, and I contend that single event made all further study of Melungeons possible.
Sure.
It made it possible to really find out more about these people because they were willing to talk about it now.
And that was a time, too, when all across America these social rigid walls and divisions were coming down. Basically, it was the counterculture period, and regionalism was breaking down. The interstate highway system and media were softening and dissolving all of those rigid social distinctions. And so I think it was ripe for Melungeons and other groups like that.
It was
come
a
out.
Unique time in history. Many things came together, not just the civil rights movement, but also the Great Society. Programs that were designed to benefit Appalachia, such as VISTA, these all had a big influence in making this happen. So that's one of the reasons that my next project is going to be a book about the play itself and its impact on Hancock County and the Melungeons.
That'll be interesting. There's also something called the Melungeon Heritage Association, and I think, were you the first president of it?
I was not the first president, but I was president for a couple of years and vice president for a few more. I was very much involved in that organization. It was an organization that really grew out of internet contacts. People became very interested in Melungeon genealogy. People were curious just to find out if they had Melungeon ancestry. And the Melungeon Heritage Association was created to be kind of a clearinghouse of information and an organization that would put on annual meetings where people could exchange information, hear from speakers on various aspects of history that touch on the Melungeons. And they have a website at www.melungeon, that's MELUNGEON.org.
Okay, there wasn't a lot of competition for the Melungeon domain name, so that was good. Anyway, there are some core names, family names, that are really associated with the Melungeon population. What are some of those?
There are many names over the generations. So many surnames have come into the Melungeon population that just about any name can be a Melungeon name if a Melungeon has it. But there are family names that show up in the early census records as being free persons of color. FPC was the designation they used. And those names include Gibson, Collins, Mullins, Bunch, Goines, and a few others. That there were family names where some of the people had married into Melungeon families, so their children were considered Melungeons, but others weren't. Mullins is a very common name in this part of the country, but not all of them are Melungeons. Sizemore is another one. Many of the Sizemores actually have Indian ancestry, but some of them are Melungeon as well. But those core names, Gibson, Mullins, Bunch, and a few others, are recognized as Melungeon names, and you can go to Hancock County and you'll see those names on mailboxes very frequently.
Yeah, so before the 50s, people didn't move around much and they intermarried, you know, within their geographic area, you know, as close as first cousins and so on, so the same names would be kind of continuing to show up as being core Melungeon names, but now it's much more, you know, broad, and in the last couple, three generations of people would have been broadened out. What are some other ethnic groups in America? I mentioned at the outset that there are some groups that had been isolated but were identified by their neighbors as being different, usually based on race, but not always, sometimes based on religion, like Mennonites and Amish and so on. But what are some racial-based groups that are like the Melungeons in this area of generally the Southeast and maybe the Eastern Mid-Atlantic states?
This has been a phenomenon that was very common in the Southeastern United States. You had groups such as the Brass Ankles, in South Carolina, the Croatans in North Carolina, the Red Bones in South Carolina, and then again in Louisiana and Texas. They have common colloquial names that, you know, are kind of mysterious, like the Melungeons, but there are legends about how they got these names. They are groups that have been considered, like the Melungeons, triracial isolates, and they were generally not known outside their home areas. They might have been considered a phenomenon of a particular county or a particular region of the country. With the draft in World War II, this phenomenon became better known because, of course, the Army was segregated and people were being sent to their classification camps by local draft boards who would send them as white. And the Army would say, are you sure about that? And that became kind of a controversy with the military, with some of these people coming from southern states. And that got people interested in it, like the Library of Congress, who started doing research, and then anthropologists and others began researching and documenting these different groups.
Well, we're getting toward the end of the show, and this is so fascinating. As often happens, we could talk for an hour easily, but we have a half-hour show. Are there still people who are distinctly Melungeon, say, in Hancock County? Can you go up in the hollers and find people who are pretty much identifiable, you know, physically as being Melungeon and who would identify themselves and still have some of the same cultural kind of traits?
Some. The Melungeons have come in all different shades, all different kinds of physical characteristics. Many Melungeons kind of moved into the African-American community and so don't consider themselves Melungeons anymore. Others have become pretty much accepted as white, just like their neighbors. But there are still in some parts of Hancock County, in Lee County, Virginia, and Wise County, places like that, there are still people who are pretty much identifiable as Melungeons, maybe not so easily to outsiders, but they are known by their neighbors as being Melungeon.
In people like yourself, you know, professional people who, you know, live normally in the community, I imagine it's more a state of mind and of personal and private identity than anything else, really. So what has been the impact on you, Wayne, and your life of the realization that you're a Melungeon and the search for the identity and kind of origins of the Melungeon people? Has it changed you much or just been an intellectual exercise?
Well, it has a personal meaning in terms of finding out who your people were, who your ancestors were, the kind of things that they had to deal with, things that happened to my family, to people that I knew, to my uncles, to my grandmother, to members of my family that I knew and knew some of the things they faced. So I think it gave me an appreciation of my own family that a lot of people get when they study family history. They learn to appreciate that. I think the broader meaning of the Melungeons is that these categories don't really mean anything. These are people who, when you look at your family, they're your family. They're the people that you love, the people that loved you, and you can't really categorize them. And as people break down these artificial barriers of ethnicity and race, we're going to find that there are people who are harder to categorize, like the Melungeons were. And it's not necessary to categorize them. They're human beings. They're American citizens. You know, whatever their identity, they are who they are. And the idea of race is obviously a very artificial concept.
Well, again, out there, listeners, if you want to learn more about this fascinating subject, go to Wikipedia and type in Melungeon, or you can go to the Melungeon.com website.
Melungeon.org.
Melungeon.org. And you can certainly get Walking Toward the Sunset by Wayne Winkler, my guest. Wayne, thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to you all for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.